Blog Talk Radio.
Yay!
Hi, this is Kara Bruda, and we're back for another episode of the Your Home Hope Online Book Club. And I'm here today with the amazing Jenna Blum, who's, I mean, just one of the authors that I've just been amazed with and dazzled by since I first read the first book that I read by her, which is Those Who Save Us. She's also the author of The Storm Chasers, and both of them are fabulous books, very different books, and I can't believe that she's here as my guest. So, Jenna, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be talking to you finally.
I know. And Jenna and I have realized that we've been friends online for so long and not been able to hear each other's voices. And I guess that's the way with social media. Do you find that, Jenna?
I do. And it's sort of Twitter, especially, is a brave new world for me. I've been on probably only, you know, 6 months as a real addict. And I started out with most things, I'm kind of a Luddite. And so I'm like, oh, Facebook, Twitter, yeah, who needs it? And then all of a sudden I have a complete heroin-like reliance on them. But the great thing about Twitter is, and about Facebook, is that you throw these filaments of yourself out into the world and they catch on people, and then sometimes you actually get to talk to those people and then meet those people in, you know, the other three-dimensional world. And it's just such a great way to connect and make friends, and I think it's especially valuable for writers to support each other and help get their works out into the world.
Yeah, I think so, too. And there's something about when you boil down the essence of a tweet, which makes, I mean, people make fun of me for this all the time because I'm always defending Twitter, but that when you have just 140 characters and you, what you say matters. And if you put out there what you believe and what you think and you feel, people can kind of tell the type of person that you are. And I think you do that, Jenna, with everything that you do. And it's a piece of you, but it's really insightful as to what kind of person you are and what kind of woman. And I think that you draw other people into your tribe that way as well. So I'm just happy that we found each other.
I am too. Thank you. Yeah, it really is like an extraordinary thing. I also like travel so much to promote my books. I'm probably on the road 300 out of 365 days of the year, and that might be a conservative estimate. And since I have this online support community, it really is like having a community of friends in my back pocket on my iPhone, you know, buzzing me every couple of minutes. And it's really, really helpful. You know, it helps us all stay connected.
So how long have you been traveling that much for your work, I mean, to promote your books? I mean, is that something that just keeps building, or did it just kind of happen over time?
Well, it is kind of a crop rotation thing. My creative life tends to be feast or famine that way. If I'm writing, I'm in what I call the Writer's Protection Program, which means I wear the same yoga pants for like 3 days in a row. I don't leave the house except to get more coffee and to walk my Black Lab Woodrow. And then at that point, I'm like, wow, I should probably change these yoga pants because the people at the coffee shop have seen the same pair for 3 days. So I'm really in lockdown with my characters and their stories and trying to tune in only to them, because the noise of then the real world is like a radio signal that's competing. And so I really try and immerse completely in the fictional world. And then when I'm done with writing a book and have been sprung from that fictional world, I really like to go out and meet the real people who are kind enough to read my characters and then make them real too, kind of like the Velveteen Rabbit principle of writing and reading, like people read your characters and it makes them real. And then I get to travel around to whomever asks me to show up and talk to people about those characters. And so basically, if somebody asks me to go somewhere, I go. And the challenge of it is geographic. If I'm going to be in Florida for 2 weeks, for instance, or if I get, you know, hits from book clubs in Florida or fundraisers or so on, I will say, okay, I'm going to be there in March or in November, and let's try and make this all work. So right now my life is a big jigsaw puzzle of speaking, because I have been promoting my second book, The Storm Chasers, in hardcover for the last 11 months. And today it is out in paperback, which is, you know, really exciting. And, you know,
I know, congratulations.
In bookstores and online, and thank you. And so there's a whole new sort of virtual and online and digital push for it, but I will continue to travel around the country speaking at book clubs, in person, phone, Skype, what have you.
Yeah, and that's a lot. So that's a lot of work. I mean, I still don't understand this, because I'm new to this whole fiction world of how
you're
save.
It's good here.
I know. I'm so excited. I can't believe it actually. But the whole notion of saving enough energy, I guess, to create your next work while you're putting yourself out there so much discussing what's already in existence. I mean, does that ever become a problem, or you, I guess you carve out that spot, that space for yourself?
You do, and I mean, I'm a very spoiled writer in some senses because I can govern my own ebb and flow. I mean, in as much as you can ever do that, there's like some dependence on inspiration, you know, and you are always negotiating bargains between inspiration, which you pray will, you know, strike you with a lightning bolt from above, and then your agent's insistence that you start a new book because it's a business aside to it also. And in between somewhere there is the writer. And I think that because I don't, for instance, have like four beautiful children or, you know, another full-time job, I have a lot of writer friends who do this incredible, to me, balancing act, this great, admirable thing where they balance family life and outside professional life and they write books, and so they're trying to fit everything in a sort of different jigsaw puzzle. My life has been about writing and then promoting the writing and researching the writing, so I can kind of orchestrate the seasons to suit my own schedule. Like this summer, for instance, I will be traveling to promote the Storm Chaser paperback, and I will be hosting Storm Chase tours. That's like, you know, my other alternate strange life. But I anticipate, too, sort of hiding away for the latter half of the summer and starting to do the research for the third book, and that's something that I'm timing very deliberately because I have to put the brakes on and say, it's time for you to lie in your hammock and read these books, and then you need to start writing short stories and asking, like, who are these people who are going to be the next protagonists?
And that's and your stories are so different. Is that purposeful, or do you just wait for an inspiration and a story to grab you, and then it will take you wherever you want?
Well, the way it works for me is that I have some emotional situation that I'm trying to puzzle out, and it's usually a question without an answer. For instance, the emotional question that was the key in The Ignition for Those Who Save Us is, why are people so mean to each other? Which is something that I have been, you know, perplexed about since childhood when I first understood it, what the Holocaust was. And for people who don't know what that first book is about, my Reader's Digest condensed version is that it's about a German woman, a non-Jewish German woman, who becomes the mistress of an SS officer to protect herself and her little daughter during World War II when she's discovered as a member of the resistance, and then the daughter's quest 50 years later to find out what the mom did, because the mom will never talk about it. And so basically I was taking this question, you know, how can man be so inhumane to man or woman for that matter, and putting it in a historical context that I was really interested in, which was World War II. And for Storm Chasers, I kind of did the same combination. I took an emotional situation that was very important to me, which is how far would you go to protect a beloved family member if he's a danger to himself or to you? And that book is about twins, one of whom is bipolar. And I put that in the context of storms because I've always been fascinated with storms and dangerous weather. And so to me, the books are both quite similar, actually. They share the same DNA, even though they have different faces, because they're both about people who survive trauma, people whose lives are rearranged by huge forces beyond their control, whether it's Nazi Germany or severe weather or mental illness, and then how those people try and rebuild their lives in the aftermath of the trauma, despite the burden of secrecy and guilt.
Wow, I think you've answered that before.
I think I probably have somewhere.
Yeah, I know. No, but that just makes so much
sense. The way I talk, Kara, you know, I just go around speaking in, you know, really, really long paragraphs. So
I know, no, but it was great because to make a connection between, I mean, from the outside and having read both books and enjoyed both books to me as the reader, I see the emotional context that are the same, but then the settings and being able to describe those worlds so well and so completely, that's what impresses me so much. So far in my writing, I've only been setting my stories in the same locale, which is very much a suburban, type community that is really close to where I grew up, that kind of a setting. So it's very familiar. And to me, then that kind of a setting gives me the grounding that I need to have my characters kind of soar. But I would love
right,
to be
right.
able to create a setting that's outside of this, you know, mythical suburb that I've been using as my backdrop someday. So that's, I guess, what's so amazing to me is that you can capture these worlds so completely and they're so distinct.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's kind of the painstaking research that I do that is the reason why it takes me longer to come out with a book than other authors and probably longer than my agent would prefer. I seem to be incapable of writing a novel that doesn't require like 3 to 5 years of painstaking research. And I think that I partly take the emotional situations and place them in such distinct contexts because it feels more like a disguise to me, and fiction is a disguise.
Right.
I mean, you're writing about something that means something really deep to you, the author, but you want to disguise it or you would be writing a memoir. So for me, making it then again once removed by setting it, excuse me, in a different time period or among a world populated with, you know, violent weather and in a completely made-up plot helps to distance me from the emotional subject so that I can really look at it and examine it from all facets. And I mean, what that helps me to do with both books and hopefully with the third book too is to pose a question to which there's no easy answer, but to ask the reader to come up with her own answers.
Right. And that distance. And when you teach, you teach a lot and you talk a lot to writers, I know, around the country. And is that kind of emotional distance one of the key, I guess, things that you teach people when you're working with them?
Not at all, because I think that each writer has his or her own process, and I work with, primarily for the last several years, I've been working at this amazing writing community called Grub Street Writers in Boston, which is a writing school for adults that started out as like 2 fiction classes, fiction and poetry, and then now encompasses like, you know, 1,000 classes ranging from everything from like screenwriting to like Moms Who Write and so on. And we have like our big, huge writers conference, The Muse in the Marketplace, coming up this weekend. So that's really exciting because, you know, they give me a soapbox and a captive audience and I get to talk about like flashbacks and stuff. But anyway, when I teach for Grub Street, I teach novelists, and that basically means we sit around a table and read somebody's book, discuss what its strengths are, and then what could be improved. And so we do a sort of supportive editorial job on these novels in progress, which I'm happy to say then go on to get published and enjoy great success. So that makes me really happy. And my job as the editor is not to tell people how to write or to speculate on the emotional or psychological process of their writing, but actually to detach what I know of the writer from the book and look at the book as its own entity. Mm-hmm. Because these people over time, since I've worked with some of them for like 5 years, are my best friends. I know their lives.
Yeah.
I know what goes on behind the scenes in their lives. And then they produce these creatures, like these fantastic books, like these worlds that are sort of tethered to them by an umbilicus of emotion, but they are their own creatures. So my job is to sort of look at that and say, well, what's working here and what's not working here? And sometimes people write straight from the hip and are, you know, putting down what happened to them like yesterday on paper. And sometimes they're writing about situations that require 20 years worth of distance. So it's probably a little helpful to have a little bit of distance so that you can be objective about your own work. But since no writer is completely objective, that's why we have places like Grub Street.
Right. Right. And that, see, and that's so neat that you have that there. And do you guys do online courses as well, or is Grub Street pretty much an in-person?
Grub hasn't done online courses yet. We have so far kept the workshops in person, and I know that they're investigating the online options since, you know, most of the world is investigating its online options these days. But the pedagogy behind that was that it really helps to create and then foster that sort of covenant of trust that's necessary for workshops if you're sitting in the room with the writer and you know, like, your turn is next. You know, it's sort of, there's an atmosphere of respect that I think, I mean, you can probably see this just from looking at, like, Amazon reviews, for instance. Like, people tend to forget, if you're online, that there's a person on the other end of what you're writing. And
right.
So I think having people in the same room discussing their very vital emotional fiction has been very helpful so far.
And speaking of reviews and those kind of things,
yes.
I mean, do those hurt you still? I mean, I'm getting my first ones, and I mean, I got them from my nonfiction book, obviously, but it's, for me, fiction, it's just so much more, you know, personal, and it is. And to get these reviews, and I, especially the negative ones, it's like, oh, boy, that hurts. I don't know.
Yeah,
they do.
They always hurt. They do. In fact, I was just whining and griping about this last night with a friend of mine who's also a writer. I was having, like, a really big martini, and we were sort of catching up on each other's days, and I was saying, I got this really pinchy review on Amazon for the Storm Chasers, and the person who was doing the reviewing claimed that I hadn't visited the geographies that I described in the book or hadn't gotten them accurately down on paper. And I was just sort of like whining and griping about this, and my friend said, well, you know, you could be focusing on like the 200 positive reviews that you
right.
also have on your page. And I said, well, you know, it does not work that way. There's always, you look at the positive reviews, you appreciate them. I like sort of get down on my knees every time I have one. I always write back to my readers who write to me directly. I read all my reviews on Amazon, and if they're good, I just say, you know, send up a prayer of thanks for that. And it's always the ones that are not so great that pinch you. What happens is, because when you're a writer, you voluntarily put yourself in the stocks, you're really not allowed to, it's not really great form to respond to reviewers in any way, even if they say things that are, like, just factually not right, but, you know, you've kind of signed up for that. So what tends to happen is when you get a review, it is like somebody reaching through your computer and giving you a really hard pinch. And then for the next couple of hours, a bruise comes up from that pinch, and then you forget about it. And sometimes if you're like ranting in the shower, that helps quite a bit, I found.
Okay, good.
that would be my recommendation. You know,
okay. Yeah, and then over time the bruise kind of fades, and as long as somebody doesn't pinch you in the exact same spot again.
Yeah, but you know what? The bruise, they do pinch you in the same spot every time, but the bruise always fades, and that's the good news. And then it is the good reviews that stick with you. And primarily, I feel I've been so lucky, and I hope for you and expect for you the exact same experience having read your novel. But I feel like I have this great, like, flotilla of support from readers that sort of forms the bedrock on which I walk every day. You know, I mean, that is what the good reviews and the generous comments and people who take the time out of their busy days to buy your book, read your book, write to you about your book. I mean, that really, that's a game changer. I mean, that becomes the foundation for your life. And then the bad reviews are just little pinches.
Right, because you have that support of those people that, I mean, and that's been the neatest part, you know, just getting such warm feedback and wonderful instant feedback. And because of the internet and because of everything online and the social media opportunities now, whereas in 2008 when my first novel came out, there wasn't that type of instant connection, and the social media still hadn't built that big. So it's been such a difference now that even people who got the advanced review copies or people that are getting it now online and from Amazon or wherever they're getting the book now, that's been amazing. And you feel like you feel so fortunate that you've been able to create something that touches other people's lives and these characters. I loved how you were describing that. You get to learn more about your characters from the people, how people respond to them.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating thing. Stephen King, whom I had a great fondness for, especially his earlier work, described it as sort of miraculous telepathy that occurs between the writer and the reader. You know, you create these people, and then through the telepathy of writing, other people know the same people that you've created, but they have like a slightly different perspective on them, and it's always interesting to see them reflected back.
Oh, it's so interesting. And then having people ask these questions about the characters and getting to rethink about them all over again, it's been so much fun. I love that.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it is. I hope, too. I don't know if you're going to be going and talking at book clubs and so on, but I mean, it's really just such a privilege to, you know, bludgeon my way into people's houses and sit there and drink wine and eat crackers and cheese and cake and talk about the characters
and argue
about the characters and the characters' choices and, you know, as though they were real, which to me they are. So that's just, it feels like a great honor to partake in those conversations.
Oh, I know. I can't wait. I can't wait. I hope to get to speak to some book clubs. I know some people have signed up already, and people are reaching out. But that would be so wonderful, because I love being in book clubs. And then the idea of actually being able to talk about something I wrote to a book club, really honoring, would be really great. I would like that
it is.
Very much.
It is an amazing experience. Yeah.
Okay, and I just have to ask you about your amazing experience that you just got back from Amsterdam.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, what was that like?
Incredible. Totally surreal and like being in a fantastic dream. The reason I went to Amsterdam is I have this great Dutch publisher, Boekerij, and which I'm pronouncing wrong. And they imported me because the Susevas, which there is called Het Family Portret, or the Family Portrait, is doing like oddly well and has been on the Dutch bestseller list for some reason for, you know, gosh, I can't remember, maybe 30 weeks or something now. And so they asked, would I come over and meet readers? And I said, of course. Are you crazy?
Right.
I mean, I'll be there on the next plane, basically. And so when I got there, I found that not only were they promoting Those Who Save Us, but they also were promoting The Storm Chasers, which in Dutch is called Im Triestrijd, or Torn in Two, because they're trying to highlight the situation in the novel about a pair of twins being torn apart by the brother's mental instability. So they have this fantastic cover for the Storm Chasers, which are these like endearingly awkward little twins. With the girl has like really squinty little eyes and knobby knees, and she's holding a big cat for some reason. And they're just such vulnerable, sweet children, and they look like they expect really good things to happen. In my books, really bad things happen. So they captured like the great essence of the book. And it's amazing to see people put a stamp on your imagination that way. But even more amazing was as soon as I walked out of Schiphol Airport and was met by the publicist for the publisher, she said, oh, look at that. And I said, look at what? And she gestured, and they had put the book on a billboard outside of the airport, and in fact, several billboards, and it was like on buses. And I mean, I just instantly became
this
idiot American taking out my iPhone and taking as many pictures as possible until she kindly reminded me, like, I had an interview. But the Dutch people, it seems to me, still elevate their writers to the same level of cultural ambassadorship that Americans used to when, like, Hemingway and co. were in Life magazine. So there's still that element of revering books, and I know that American readers love their writers, and I know the publishers do too. It just, there's like a different flavor to it, and that was really interesting and amazing for me to experience.
Well, I mean, you just gave me the chills even talking about it, because that has to be something, like you said, so surreal, because you've been hugely successful in the States, but to get that kind of consolidated, I guess, what would it be, endorsement, you know, just having everyone, you know, so stopped and stunned by what your work is, and that's got to be amazing.
It was just kind of, there is, I think, an essential disconnect with writing anyway, because, again, like, if you're like me, you're writing in a room because you love your characters, you love their stories, you're kind of possessed by them, you are wearing your yoga pants and whatever. I mean, it's not a glamorous thing. And then you go out into the world and people know the characters, and so there is that miraculous, like, alchemy slash telepathy. But to then have people really revere the characters or revere the books to that magnitude, it makes me feel very spoiled and a little bit sheepish, because there are a lot of writers out there doing really, really good work and working really, really hard. So why should it be that, you know, these particular books are given this kind of treatment? I mean, all I can do is sort of wander through that part of my life feeling bemused and grateful and enjoying every single second in appreciation, and then trying to the best of my ability to share it with people online on my website or on Facebook or on Twitter without making them absolutely despise me. So I'm hoping that I'm walking that line well enough.
I think most people would love to celebrate with you, and I think you do a great job of sharing your excitement and passion for what you're doing, and really the thanks that you feel for the readers and the publisher and everything. I mean, that's part of the journey too, and I think we're so used to and accustomed to as people who want to become authors and then about to be published authors, of hearing all the struggle stories and hearing all the work that does come into it, which obviously there does. and, you know, it is a tough job, and it's a tough business right now especially. So to hear and watch somebody who is genuine and who's worked hard on what she's put into the marketplace and have such success and be able to share that with you, I think it's a wonderful thing.
I hope
so. Don't feel bad.
Thank you. I also
yeah, don't
know. Thank you. I just feel also to some degree, you know, if this can happen to me, it can happen to you. Like there's a great movie about called It Can Happen to You about a waitress who wins the lottery. You know, I feel like that a little bit. I mean, before I wrote this to Save Us, somebody asked me this morning during an interview, you know, how long did it take you to become a writer? And I was like, well, 33 years. You know, I had that novel be rejected by 47 agents before my agent decided to take a chance on it. So all writers endure a certain amount of rejection or, you know, more or less rejection. You have to just sort of keep plowing ahead. And I do feel as though if it could happen to me, it could happen to you. You just have to really, really keep sawing wood, as my grandfather would have said.
I would, yeah, and keep banging your head against shut doors and all that other good stuff. But yeah,
yeah,
and it does.
Good. I know we have really hard heads, writers.
Oh really gosh, good. Yeah, and I mean, and then of course there are those pinches too that come along the way. So you've got to be
hard
heads
and thick skin.
Out.
You know,
yeah,
that's probably
exactly.
What people say. Well, what does it take to be a writer? There's a certain anatomy that goes that goes into it. You have to be sort of hard headed and thick skinned.
You do. And then on top of all of that, then you have to put yourself out there and you're sharing your perspective on the world, which when you come right down to it, you were just asking me what it felt like to be 6 days out of before publication.
So
and
it's
exciting. And then the next minute I'm like scared to death. And then the next minute I'm excited again. So it is. It's just you're kind of putting things out there. And it's not you, but it is you. Because it's your perspective on things, so it's an odd feeling. It is.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about before. In terms of, you are kind of disguised. I mean, again, when you're a writer, you put yourself in the stocks quite willingly. Like you walk up the little hill and you put your arms in the holes and they shut them on you, and people can throw stuff at you, and they might throw flowers or they might throw tomatoes. But you know, either way, that's kind of what you signed up for. But I do feel at least, you know, we get some protection from the fact that we write fiction. If I were writing memoir or if I were an actor, for instance, you know, going out to auditions and people are like, nah, she's too fat, she's too short, she's too old. I mean, that would be really hard. So I do feel that we take risks putting our stuff out there, but we don't ever, as fiction writers, have to admit to exactly what it is that feels like it's under attack, except maybe to like family or friends, you know, really close friends, to say, oh my God, I can't believe this reader didn't get this character, or oh my gosh, I can't believe that this message didn't seem to come across to this reader. Primarily, we, you know, can say, ah, it's fiction, and, you know, it's not a good show.
Right. And keep moving on to the next book and to the next book club that likes you. Yeah. Which is
right,
good.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
Anyway, I'm coming. Yeah, I've got to go. I'll be right back. And
right, right
out the door.
Exactly.
Okay, so what age did you think that you were going to be a writer? I mean, did you know early on?
Four.
Four?
Yeah, four.
Wow.
Yeah, that was like the first one-word answer I ever gave to anything, which, you know, I'm just sort of marveling at that in and of itself. Yeah,
me too,
my
actually.
Dad was a writer. He was a broadcast news writer, and he wrote for the networks in their sort of golden era. So he wrote for CBS and NBC and ABC and Walter Cronkite and so on. And so I grew up with his typewriter as a sort of soundtrack to my memories. Now I'm really dating myself because, you know, only certain people of a certain age remember what typewriters are.
Right.
But I always wanted to be like my dad, and I started writing when I was about four, like these deeply thought-provoking, incisive stories about mermaids and princesses. And I decided I wanted to be a barber for a little while in addition to being a writer, so I wrote about haircuts and, you know, like illustrated all of these things. And just never really wanted to be anything else. My parents encouraged me. I had some early success with like short stories and early publications, and decided the world owed me a living as a writer, and found out quickly the world owed me a living in food service. I did for like a couple of decades while I was trying to get published. And so it really has been this sort of very extensive and highly colorful board game to get to this like beautiful and surreal place. And, you know, it is kind of like a chutes and ladders thing. You're only as good as your next book, and your next book is only as good as much heart you put into it. So, you know, you could slide down the chute, or you could keep climbing up or stay in the same place. I don't take anything for granted.
But as far as, I don't know, establishing your career and having this platform that you've built now, it seems to me, and I have no idea, but it seems to me at least you could start feeling a little more secure from the chutes and ladders, maybe that you wouldn't shoot so far down, you know, that you have a little...
I don't know. You know, I'm of two minds about that. I mean, the one thing, because I'm a Libra, so I can equivocate greatly on any point. I think... One thing that I feel like I can stand on, and this, again, was an amazing thing to me, is that Those Who Save Us is a New York Times bestseller. And, like, once that happens, then you can say, like, on your deathbed, no matter what happens to you, hey, I was a New York Times bestseller. So that's, like, the kind of stripe that doesn't ever get taken away, and that's kind of cool. On the other hand, since I, you know, tend to like to see the dark side of things, as is in the book, I can sometimes envision people saying, oh, I love that first book, and the second book was okay, or the second book was really great, the first book, but then what happened to her? Or, you know, oh, I thought she was dead. You know, I mean, you imagine all these awful scenarios where, you know, these things happen. And I think in the long run, between those two scenarios of, like, the pinnacle of the Times, which was such a fantastic, you know, in the true sense of the word thing, like a dreamlike thing, and the worst-case scenario, which is I'll never write again and I'll fade into, like, total obscurity and my books will be sold at, like, tag sales and stuff, like curios. The point I feel that I'm at now is that with two books under my belt and whom readers have been very kind to, I can take a little bit of time for my personal life, which, quite frankly, for the last, you know, several decades, I haven't been able to do. So I can just, you know, look around a little bit and breathe and say, okay, I'm going to sort of tend to this side of my life and then I'll get back to hitting the books.
And so taking that time and being able to, you think you're going to be able to tell yourself to do that since you're so used to doing the other part of life and focusing on this fiction world?
I think so. I mean, I hope so. I do feel as though I have slowed down a little bit in terms of, I mean, I've always been very full throttle because for years publishing anything and sending out stories despite rejection and drafting and drafting and drafting books and sending them out and having them rejected, that took absolutely every ounce of energy I had. And I was married when I was really young. I was like a child bride and, you know, barely in my 20s. And my then husband was absolutely wonderful. But he didn't get the writing thing and why that was such an imperative to me and wanted to start a very young family, and I wasn't really in the mood to start a young family. I wanted to write books. So it took me I didn't have the energy for it, and I had been going, you know, full throttle ever since with publishing the books and then promoting the books and then traveling around to promote the books and writing another book. And now I think there is a way to fold those experiences together, by which I mean I can research my next book and write the short stories that are the template for the next book, but I can also sort of slice and dice in more personal time without feeling like, oh my gosh, if I don't keep doing this 120%, it's all going to collapse.
Good.
So
yeah, that's good.
You know, like a sort of stage of some security, but again, I keep in mind that all of this is a gift and I don't take it for granted.
Right, because I think it is. It's hard, especially when you're so driven like you have been, and because of that drive, you've achieved great success, to be able to turn around and say, okay, but there are other components, and that's kind of one of the themes that I write about as well, is how do you find that balance, and how do you make your life fulfilled and whole, so it's not just myopically pursuing, you know, your career dreams, and it's not, you know, and it's tough because especially, I think, I don't know if it's especially in fiction writing, but I feel like, you know, there is some sense of a treadmill once you do have success to keep producing. So I'm glad that you're going to take some time for yourself too.
There is definitely that feeling that you have to keep producing. But I think books, especially, well, my books, and sometimes fiction, take a long time to produce anyway. So if you're going to sort of have a little breathing room in a very dedicated professional life so that you can also have a personal life, it may add, like, you know, an extra 6 months or 9 months or a year or something to the creative process. But, you know, it seems now much more like a doable thing than it did when I was in my 20s and felt this sort of frantic need to get the books out there before a bus hit me or a piano fell on me or something, you know.
Now
it's kind of just like, okay, I can relax a tiny bit. I mean, it's one of the things I admired greatly about the heroine, your heroine in Here, Home, Hope, or like H3, which is sort of like what I call it in my head.
H3, yeah.
I mean, I found her immensely inspiring because she is somebody who is like roughly my age or a little older but had managed to sustain a personal life and a marriage and children and was reaching out then for what she wanted to do next. And I admire, again, my friends who have balanced out these different quadrants of their lives and are living very fully instead of, as you said, sort of myopically. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody comes to it differently. And I myself, you know, in my writer heart, go, oh my gosh, it's so great that you did this and that you persevered through that, you know, because meanwhile, I did have family young and, you know, and I always had a different career going and then writing on the side and just the notion of, well, it's finally coming true now. So I guess everything happens for a reason.
It does. No, I do think that's amazing. And I have, I mean, I'm returning to the word because I think it's a great word. Like, I always have been sort of myopic in terms of, you know, this is all I ever wanted to do, and this is what I'm doing. And so my friends who are writers, when I look at them, I sort of make that assumption that, like, oh, my gosh, you also have been writing since you were 4 years old and, you know, doing this, like, crazed pursuit thing. And then I remember that a lot of the people I work with at Grub Street, the novelists I work with, have, you know, had really rich, full lives that had little to do with writing except for, you know, years and years of reading and longing and sort of practicing, but, you know, not that singular sort of pursuit. And I admire people so greatly for having the courage to say, you know what, it's time for me to do this. I'm just going to like sort of step out on this ledge and do something I always wanted to do, even though it's not been in my experience since I was a little kid. I think that's phenomenal.
Yeah, and I guess I have kind of a, in my story is kind of a cross between both, because I knew from fourth grade at least, maybe sooner, earlier than that, that this is what I wanted to do. But then I guess I didn't have the courage and the guts to just stick with it and keep trying. I would try sporadically and get an agent and then give up when it didn't sell, and, you know, and then keep going back and forth. But it's quite impressive that you just kept at it, just kept focused on it. So I guess, like we're saying, there are many different ways to come to this career and to come to this world of fiction. And however you get there, it's so rewarding to get there and be able to participate
Absolutely.
In it.
Absolutely. So there is no one right way to do it. There really is no one right way to do it. I think you just have to have the love for the written word and to be possessed by a set of characters and to have something that you believe deeply in to say. And if you have that, you know, pushing at you through your whole life, at some point or another it will come out, whether or not you start developing those muscles when you're like four or whether or not you do it as an adult. And there really is the only thing I believe is required of really good writing is thought, so that, you know, you're putting thought into everything from theme to structure to word choice and punctuation and wholeheartedness. And you have to write something that you really, really wholeheartedly love and believe in.
Right, because if you don't, you will not like to talk about them 6 years later like you're doing with your books. I mean, that's
gosh. Well, I think moreover, like, it won't resonate. I think people who
right.
are writing really about something they believe in strike chords in their readers that they really reverberate. And if you're writing something because you think it will please an audience or you know, is a hot topic, or, okay, chick lit is really big right now, I'm going to write something about somebody who works at a publisher, and, you know, wears Manila Blahnik and whatever. You know, I mean, it's just like, if you don't really believe in it, readers will know that. Readers are smart. Like, readers don't have time to waste on stuff that is not really wholeheartedly felt, I think. So you sort of owe it to yourself and to them to write something that is emotional.
Yeah, I agree. And makes you smile at the end of the day, and you're proud of, because it's... Yeah, because all of a sudden it's out there in the world and you can't stop it.
right, exactly.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean,
God.
It is, I mean, despite the fact that we were sort of talking about, like, the reviews that reach through the screen and pinch you, in the end, the things that is so exasperating to me about that phenomenon is that I can justify all the choices I made for my books. I mean, there are, like, a few flaws in my German, and those who say this because, I don't speak German, as many German readers have pointed out to me quite rightly, you know. But I mean, other than that, and I full-heartedly admit that those are my errors and nobody else's, and I'm sorry to have interrupted the fictional dream by including errors in the book, and that's my bad. But otherwise, I can justify every choice that I've made for both books, from, you know, the micro to the macro. And the frustrating thing about a bad review or a bad or an ungenerous comment is that you can't explain yourself to those people and say, oh, I did it X way because why, you know, this is why. But in the end, when I go to sleep at night, I do so with the knowledge that I did the best I could by both books, and I feel really very confident in that. Like, in the end, that's what you stand on. Like, I loved this, and I wrote it, and I wrote it the best I could, and so there it is.
I know, and it's standing up. I mean, that's, to me, that's really, really, it's got to be such a great feeling that something you put out there in the world takes on a life of its own, and still over time. I mean, I think that's what distinguishes great fiction from fiction. And I don't presume to write great fiction. I think that you do, and I hope to someday elevate to that level, but I think that at the point where people are talking about it years later and they're still captivated by your characters and by their story, that's the best.
Well, thank you. I mean, what I aspire to do is to get my characters and their stories out of my head and do it the right way, so that they're because I'm the only conduit they have to the outside world, and if I can get them out and like pay an homage to them and people then get to know them, then I've done my job. And so in terms of aspiring to write something great, I actually, if you said, are you planning to write the great American novel, I would say, well, I hope Storm Chasers is a great American novel because it could only be set in America, and it's such an American book. And I love that, and I'm proud of that flavor, but I aspire to write good stories, well told, and that's, you know, the best that I can hope for. And I sometimes think that if people are talking about a book years later, it's because the book has the great good fortune to be universal enough for everybody to be able to relate to it. And I do think that's the case with Those Who Save Us, because it's a war story, and people relate to war stories in so many different levels and through so many different facets of themselves. And Storm Chasers has the sort of universal theme of personal responsibility for your family and for people you love, and mental illness, and, you know, but that's it's always just a sort of a grab bag to see, you know, gosh, this is something I care about so deeply. I wonder if it's going to reverberate with 100,000 people or 10 people or a million people. I mean, you can just write what you can write, and then you hope it's grabby.
I know. Yikes.
Yeah. No fear. I have a sense that there are a lot of readers out there who are going to love your book.
I hope so. I know. I hope so. And I so much appreciate you endorsing the book. That was amazing to me. And getting it in on time, even with all your travels all around the place. And
that was kind of amazing. I was amazed at myself. I'm usually, you know, pretty tardy. So don't spread the word out there that I actually got a quote in on time.
I know. Yeah. No. Please. You're safe. Secret's safe with me. And I know that you have a busy day with the launch of the paperback, so I want to let you go. But I really, really appreciate your time today. And thank you. And thank you for endorsing Here Home Hope, and thank you for writing great fiction that's resonating here and around the world, which is so exciting. So thank you for being with us, Jenna.
Live up to myself. That's a great description. Thank you very much. And I love Here Home Hope, so I think everybody should go out and buy it when it comes out on May 1st. And the reason that I was able to read it and turn a quote around so quickly is it was just a delight to read. And I found it very inspiring and very upbeat and very true to life. And so everybody should go out and buy it, like, you know, now on Amazon.
Aw. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it very much. And they should go buy the paperback version of The Storm Chasers if they don't happen to already have a copy in hardback. So anyway, great luck, and I will see you on Twitter.
Thank you, and Twitter and Facebook, and as they say in Holland, success.
Yeah, thanks. You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
left you on the debris. At the Sunday morning market, she was starting to the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door, and that old familiar love song. Gosh, you knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. Trouble at the depot with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money.